Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaskan Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. On tonight's show, inventor, mechanic, mountain climber, and hitchhiker, John Holmgren discusses a life of opportunities.
I always wanted a shop building to do things in. And so I built a shop, and I decided I needed tools. So I put an ad on Tradio back then, and I got a response from a guy who says, I've got every tool you need. So I went over and looked at them, and I said, yeah, but I can't afford them. I mean, this was a whole shop full of tools. And we talked for quite a while, and he said, well, how much money do you have? And I said, well, I've got $4,219 or something. We talked for another hour after that, and then he said, well, load them up. And I said, what? And he says, yeah, I'll take the $4,200, Teen, and you can have every tool in this place.
I hope you'll stick around following the news. Welcome back. My guest for the next two shows is John Holmgren. I've known about John ever since I first interviewed snow scientist Matthew Sturm years ago. Matthew, in his book, Finding the Arctic, About a 2,500-mile Journey from Fairbanks to Hudson Bay, Canada, writes about John as a machinist, miner, geophysicist, traveler, and Arctic philosopher. As you'll discover, that's a pretty fair description. Raised in Fairbanks, John received his B.S. degree in geophysics and geology from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in 1987. But by then, he'd already enjoyed a rich life with a host of experiences under his belt. John and Matthew were already mountain climbing buddies before Matthew lured John over to the U.S. Army Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory here in Fairbanks, where John fashioned instrumentation and equipment for field expeditions. As Matthew also pointed out in his book, John's machine shop and Fox attracts a wide range of characters who seek out repairs, but maybe also just good conversation. I began our talk by asking about where his mechanical aptitude came from.
I think a lot of it's genetics, but my father, besides being an engineer, did everything for himself. He built our house, he plumbed the house, he wired the house, he plastered the house, he fixed our cars, he fixed anything else that was broken. He never hired anybody to do anything for him that he could possibly do himself. And that was pretty much true his entire life. And I definitely inherited that in a big way.
Did he come from a line of engineers? When you say a genetic component,
no.
I think there must be some sort of lineage in there.
Well, no. His father was a traveling evangelist, actually, and a sort of a preacher who had, you know, six or eight churches at one time that he'd visit each week or each month, and he'd preach at various churches around, and it was not much of a living, you know. But whether you're an engineer or not is very much a genetic trait. It has to do with how your brain's built. And I look at my nephews. I've got two nephews who are now in their early 20s who are so much like me that it's hard to, it's just fun to watch. You just go, yeah, I remember all that. And whereas my kids had none of that. But they weren't my genetic kids, so it was...
You adopted them?
Yes.
Okay. Did you start tinkering or working on stuff early on too, John?
Yeah, there were always tools in the shop, in the garage. You know, Dad had a box of tools out there, and we were welcome to use them as long as we put them back. And we worked on bicycles and sleds and motorcycles as I got older. Like my father went... Just before the flood, he bought an old Volkswagen that for my mother to drive. You know, he had six kids at that time and was, you know, didn't have a lot of money. So he bought this old Volkswagen, and it kind of blew up on the way home from picking it up. Obviously, it was cheap. And so he took it apart. He had two motors, and he took them all apart. He had it all laid out on a bench, and then the flood came and dumped all this stuff into 6 inches of mud. And when he got the garage cleaned up down there, he put it all back together and made a car out of it, which my mother drove for a few years. It always smelled kind of flood-like. But he gave it to me at some point, to me and my younger brother. And we took it apart. We took the motor apart. We took all the pistons out. We put them all back together, and we still could drive it up the driveway at the end. But it still ran just as terribly as it did when we started, of course. And but that was fun, and we had a really good time doing it. And the opportunity was always there.
Mm-hmm. So when you're going through school, you said math and science issues weren't a problem for you. You felt pretty comfortable around those.
Those are the things that are easy for me to do. That's the way my brain works. You know, I worked ahead in fourth grade and did all through the sixth grade math books, you know, and it's just natural. That's sort of, you know, what I was good at. One of the things in grade school that I was always impressed with is I had a teacher named Mr. Richardson at University Park School when I was in sixth grade. And they decided that kids needed some mechanical education. And so they had parents bring in old gasoline motors and, you know, six or eight of them for the classroom, maybe more. And then he brought in a whole box of old tools. And we all took them apart, and we learned about two strokes and four strokes and pistons and how motors work inside in sixth grade. And that was a very formative thing for me. I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah.
And just the thought that, you know, still I think all sixth graders should take apart motors, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, it strikes me as that's so practical in one way. But it builds on, you know, what kid, well, at least that's true for me and my friends, we had these plastic models, you know, and everything was pretty easy to assemble. You got it. But there was a satisfaction at the end if your little airplane looked like an airplane, or maybe not so much, you know. But there was a certain satisfaction about putting things together. But you had a very practical introduction to that.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. We took things apart and we put them together all the time.
So when it's time for going to college, you mentioned your grandfather was a preacher. So was it a religious upbringing you had?
Yeah, I was brought up Baptist. My parents were they were involved in a conservative Baptist church, which maybe is not as conservative as some other ones. But yeah, I grew up in a Baptist home. And so religion was an important part of our family.
Mm-hmm.
We went to church regularly, and my parents were very involved in the church.
And did that come to play when you decided to go off to college?
Yeah, it was sort of at that point in my life, it was just sort of understood that you were headed off to some sort of Christian college or the other. And whereas I probably could have done otherwise, at the time it didn't really seem an option. And so I took off and went to Letourneau College in Texas, which was a really good engineering school. And I was always impressed with their engineering, but not necessarily with their Christianity.
Yeah.
And so I dropped out of there.
Okay. And then what'd you do? You took some time off?
Yeah, I took the next, when I came home that summer, I worked in Fairbanks for the summer. Actually, when I took off for college, my parents moved to Sitka while I was gone. The year I went to college, my parents moved to Sitka. And so when I came back to Fairbanks, I had a town to myself. It was perfect. And I stayed in a friend's basement, a friend's parents' basement, and worked that summer in an assay laboratory. And then in the fall, three of us took off and went to Europe. And we spent 7 months in Europe. And for some reason, we bought tickets from Anchorage to Amsterdam to New York. And so when we came back after 7 months in Europe, we landed in New York City. And none of us at that point wanted to spend any more time in big cities. And so we ended up in Pennsylvania. And I bought a motorcycle, a Honda 750. It was the only motorcycle for sale in town from some college professor. And he wouldn't even let me ride it until I paid him for it. And I took off and rode from Pennsylvania to Minnesota and down to Texas, and over to San Diego, and back up here to Fairbanks. And so that was kind of the first real street bike I owned.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with John Holmgren. His machine shop out in Fox is legendary, with researchers looking for well-made scientific instruments, and with locals looking for good conversation. We'll hear more following a break. This is Northern Soundings. Thank you. Welcome back. Let's return to my conversation with John Holmgren. Given his ability to repair and maintain equipment, as well as his ability to think about things, I asked him whether he knew of the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Oh, I wasn't so much into the Zen of motorcycles at that time. I enjoyed the motorcycle. It was a Honda, so I didn't have to work on it, just drove it. Riding a motorcycle is very freeing. I mean, you can go wherever you want, whenever you want. You just get on your motorcycle and turn the throttle and off you go. And so at 19, the world's a new big place out there. Growing up in Fairbanks, we got out a couple of times to the States to see the relatives and stuff. But mostly, I'd been in Fairbanks all my life. And so taking off and having the ultimate freedom of just going wherever you want and doing whatever you want. And I had a little money, so, you know, you eat in cafes or buy food or camped out, went to national parks, just wandered around.
Wow, that sounds ideal, you know. And it was a time when it was pretty easy to do that. It seems like it's kind of a different world, but maybe that's just my age.
Well, I think it's just our age. I don't know if it's as popular a thing to do, but I spent many years on the road hitchhiking as well. And it can't be much more difficult now than it was then.
Mm. Let's back you up only, though, to Europe. What was Europe like? And did it leave any lasting impressions? Because when I took a Eurail pass and I spent 2 or 3 months, I can't remember, when I was in college, just riding to all these countries. When you get back to the United States, it looks a little different. Like you've been in a different culture long enough that you think, wow, this is weird.
Yeah, there's a few things that were really different when I came back to the States. One, cars were huge. And back then, those days, European cars were quite small and American cars were quite large. And when I landed again, it was like, whoa, we have big cars. And the other thing is when I was in Europe, I started drinking beer. And I had never had any alcohol at all in my life until I was in a little youth hostel in Amsterdam. There was a refrigerator full of Heineken. And so I started drinking beer off and on, not a lot. But when I got back home, I went to my cousin's place and he gives me a beer and I cracked that thing and I drank it. And I go, oh, what is this stuff? This is not beer. You get used to real European beer and
the real deal.
The American stuff, the cheap American stuff didn't quite add up back then.
That's right. Well, let me ask you then, back you up even one step further, because when you come back to Fairbanks, you said you were doing assaying. How did you fall into that? And it became a kind of an important occupation for you for a while.
Yeah, it kind of started a streak of what I did for a living for a while. In high school, I was a math and science guy. And so when I needed a summer job, I got out the phone book and looked up engineering companies. And I just called a bunch of them. And I didn't get any calls back for a while. A few weeks later, I got a call from Resource Associates of Alaska, who were primarily a mining exploration company. But they had an engineering surveying branch, and they did some other things. And they called me up and said, can you come in? And I said, sure. So I came in and he said, well, we could put you to work in a rock room. And I go, okay. And so I went to work crushing rocks. So they'd take mineral samples and we'd crush them powder into a powder. And then you'd take this powder into the lab and dissolve it in acid and measure the mineral content of various, you know, the metal content mostly is what we were doing.
You know, a lot of geologists I've talked to like being out in the field. You were in the lab there. Did you ever hanker to be out collecting samples?
Well, yeah. And I, when I came back from Europe, I came back and I told them that I didn't want to work in the lab anymore and I wanted to be in the field. And they said, fine, we'll put you out staking mining claims. In fact, you can go out here in a week with Jim Munsell, who's been a really good friend of mine for the last 30, 40 years. Almost. And they just put two of us out in Ruby staking mining claims together for 2 months. And so field work was really fun. I enjoyed being in the field. And that's really why I ended up going into geology in college, was just because that's what I was working in.
And you studied at UAF?
I did. I finished my degree. It was kind of an odd degree. It was nominally in geology, but I didn't take the geology classes. I didn't want to. And I had a lot of math and physics classes. So they gave me a sort of invented degree, geology with a geophysics option at the time.
Well, now that's really interesting to me. A lot of people who have attended UAF, one of the draws is there's really an intimacy or more access to your professors. Did you find that the size of UAF and its program worked for you that way?
It did. And it takes a few years. I mean, you go to college in the first few years, you kind of know who your professors are, but you don't really know them as people. And then towards my senior year, I certainly got to know my professors more as people and, you know, what they actually did outside of teaching class and things like that. And that was very rewarding to be part of, in this case, the geology department. You know, you were part of the department, and the department was a real entity. And that was good, but not good enough to get me to go back to grad school.
Well, but you do meet a grad student there that you eventually climb mountains with, Matthew Sturm?
Yep. Matthew and I met at the Sandvik House, which was kind of a notorious climber's hangout at the time. And he came in looking for a climbing partner. And most people came to the Sandvik House for parties, but he came looking for a climbing partner. And so we ended up climbing a number of mountains together and spent some time together. And we had classes together at university as well, math and physics classes mostly. He was in glaciology.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, this is kind of a fascinating thing for me. What was mountain climbing like, and how did you get into that, John?
I got into mountain climbing because when I was 16, another good friend now, Dan Soley, attended our church. And he had climbed Denali when he was quite young. He must have been 20 or something. And he came to church and gave a slideshow on climbing Denali. And I thought, that's something I'd like to do someday, is go climbing. And so when I went to college, they had an Alpine Club. So I started going to Alpine Club meetings, and eventually they had a climbing class, and we started there and got fairly involved with just going down to the mountains and going up stuff.
It's always, I think, when you go up those, it's coming down that would be tricky, I think, too.
Yes, and surprisingly tiring coming down. You know, you got to lower yourself back down just like you push yourself up. And going down is much more dangerous a lot of times.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with John Holmgren. John's abilities to design and fabricate robust scientific instruments and field equipment are featured in the book Finding the Arctic. We'll hear more following the break. This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Welcome back. I'm talking over the next two shows with John Holmgren. In his time, he's run a dredge operation, motorcycled across the country, and built and designed durable scientific instruments and equipment for the field. Let's get back to the conversation. Before we talk about going out in the field with Matthew, I do want to talk a little bit more about your experience as a mining engineer. Eventually, you run a a dredge operation. Is that right?
Well, it wasn't quite like that. But I started off staking mining claims, did a lot of work in the mountains down in Alaska Range doing soil sampling and geophysics, and we built helipads in the mountains, helicopter pads and drill pads, which was very, very hard work, moving rocks and making flat places in the mountains. It was all helicopter work. They helicoptered us out every day, and we took samples, and we did geophysical surveys, and we did all sorts of mining exploration. And I did that for a number of years, and then I decided that I did not want to work on a helicopter crew anymore. You could see that helicopters were dangerous and somebody was going to get hurt. And I just decided, you know, I'd rather go out. And at the time, they had a big placer division. A big chunk of their effort.
And this is the same company you started out with, the
Resource Associates, yeah. And so they had a partner, actually, and they were staking a lot of mining claims and mining. And so I ended up going out with a drill crew drilling creeks for gold. And so this is placer mining, so you're getting the gold out of the gravel in a big sluice box and heavy equipment and whatnot. And so all these creeks have to be drilled first. And so you go out there with a drill rig and you drill holes and you pull up samples and you pan these samples out and weigh the gold. And that's what I was doing, as I was the panner. And so I would, you know, take the samples and run through a little machine and pan them out in a gold pan and put them in little containers and weigh them and tell them how much gold was in their hole and where in the hole it came from.
And you did this principally by weight, is that it?
Yeah, you'd weigh the gold samples. And so I did that for a while. And then eventually Resource Associates sold their placer interest to a company called Great Northwest, later Sphinx America, who actually was running a mine. And I ended up, I was going to be running a mine here in Fairbanks, and my boss called me up one day and said, "Can you come out to the creek?" And I go, "Sure." And he says, "Bring some clothes." And I said, "Okay." And I showed up on the creek, and he said, "We took a vote, and you're the new mine foreman." And I had never done any mining, but everybody out there was a miner. They all knew what they were doing, more or less. I just was the referee. And so I got to say what got done, but I had to pay attention to, you know, the guys that knew.
But that's a long, long hours, right?
We worked, at least 80 hours a week, I did. We were working two shifts around the clock, so everybody either worked day shift or night shift. And then I'd work day shift, and then I'd go out at night shift to get night shift straightened out and doing what they're supposed to do. And anytime I woke up in the middle of the night and I didn't hear the sluice box making noise, I had to get up and go find out why. But it was a good job. It was just really demanding physically and mentally. It was ongoing. You'd be out there for 9 months straight just working the whole time. Mm. And so at the end of 2 years, I told them I was done. I couldn't do it anymore. I didn't want to. I just, you know, didn't matter how much money I was making. It just wasn't worth it.
Right. And then you take a break, though. When is this when you start hitchhiking?
No, I hitchhiked before that. I hitchhiked during college, basically. I went to college sort of semester on, semester off. Mm-hmm. Which is one of the nice things at the University of Alaska. They're pretty loose on, or they were, on, you know, whether you went straight through or not. And so I went to college for 5 years at the university, and I was gone half of those 5 years. So.
And what was the appeal of, instead of getting on another motorcycle and heading off down the road, you decide to hitchhike? Why hitchhike?
No, hitchhiking is a fascinating business. It you have the freedom to do whatever you want. You have less baggage. You don't have a motorcycle or anything. And principally, you meet people. And so hitchhiking alone, you meet new people every day, all day, assuming you get very many rides. And you meet lots of fascinating people. You meet dangerous people and you get in dangerous situations. But most of the people are like most of the people in the world. They're good folks. And they're interested in what you're doing and why you're out there. And one time I was in Texas and I went to this little cafe early in the morning. And I walked in and there was just an old man in the cafe who was the waitress and the cook and everything else. And I ordered my eggs and bacon or whatever, and so I sat down and he came over to my table and he said, "Son, when was the last time you called your mother?" And I said, "I don't know, it's been a month or so." And he says, "The phone's over there." And he said, "Go call your mother." And so I did, and I had a good talk with my mom, and I came back and talked with him, and he said, yeah, he had gotten an argument with his son, and it had been 3 years since he'd heard from his kid. And so people are people. And you run into, the most fascinating people. People offered me jobs, and I drove a brand new Lincoln Continental all the way up the East Coast for a guy who picked me up hitchhiking. He rolled down his window and he said, "Can you drive?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, "Let me see your driver's license." So I showed him. He says, "You're driving." And he had just bought it in Atlanta or somewhere, and I drove all the way up to New York City.
I think for a lot of people, I hitchhiked a little bit in the United States, but when I, again, traveling in Europe, people in Europe seem much more, it was just understood that students in the summer would be hitchhiking and people would pick up and you'd, like you say, get interesting conversations. I never felt like I was a threatening situation, but in the United States, there's this kind of worry that you're going to Charles Manson and the family will pick you up or something.
Yeah, it was understood that it could be dangerous. But I was young, male, tall, awful young though, in my 20s, early 20s. I look at my kids, or other people I know in their early 20s, and I think, But I was very independent. The times you run into all sorts of people with other agendas who want to steal your backpack or sexual predators. There's a lot of people out there you really don't want to associate with. People into drugs, and I got rides with people who shot at signs out the window. You see all the bullet holes in the signs, and I never imagined exactly how that happened, but I got rides with people who did that. And there's situations you'd rather not be in, and I was always able to extricate myself one way or the other.
How would you do
Mostly just get out of the car. At any
that?
opportunity, I
Yeah.
jumped out of two cars at 20 miles an hour with my backpack. Sometimes you gotta. There was other times when I thought I was gonna have something was gonna go wrong and never did. I got a guy ride with a guy who had a pistol tucked in his sock, and who was a very weird individual. And that one turned out good. And
Oh man, did you get to a point, John, where you felt like you were pretty good at reading people?
well, certainly, the more time you spend getting to know unknown people, so to speak. I mean, meeting people that you don't know, thrown into a situation where you have to deal with people. You certainly learn a lot in that process. And hitchhiking as well is an art. It's not something that you learn right away. One time I got a ride here out of Fairbanks heading down the Parks Hideaway. And I got out to the parks and I had to get back to Geology Field Camp down on the Denali Highway. So I was hitchhiking down, and there was three guys standing there, which is really rare for Fairbanks. We all got picked up in a pickup truck, and we got dropped off at Ferry, down by Healy, where there's nothing, just a blank, empty road. And so there's four of us now, and I told these guys, I can get the first ride. You guys decide where I am. We're going to spread out along the road. You guys tell me where to hitchhike, and I'll get the first ride. And And so they did. They put me third. And so we're all standing out there hitchhiking. About 10 minutes later, a semi truck comes by, blows past the first two guys, slams on his brakes, picks me up. I jump into the cab and we blow past the fourth guy. And I've never heard this story from any of those three people. I don't know who they were, but I'm sure this story's been told. And what they didn't know is this truck driver had picked me up 3 days previously on the way up to Fairbanks. But it is an art. You have to communicate with the drivers as well before they pick you up.
So you're projecting what?
Well, you want to be happy. Yeah. You want to be neat. You want to look like somebody they want to pick up. You want to look engaged. You know, you're never clean and beautiful or anything. You're on the road for a long time. But if you look, interested more than anything else.
Did you get in good conversations?
All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, just fascinating people. People who had done all sorts of things. One day I got a ride with an avocado grower, which has impressed me ever since, because he told me you could harvest avocados anywhere over a 3-month period or something, from when they got ripe enough to harvest to when you had to harvest them. Yeah, which is something I didn't know.
You
learn all sorts of interesting things.
Yeah, I bet you do. Okay, so you've just done as foreman. You've had enough of that. What did you think you would do next?
Well, I had decided that I wanted to build a shop. I had a little cabin up here in Goldstream, and I had a piece of land, and I always wanted a shop building to do things in. And I didn't need to live in one. I had a little 10-by-12 cabin, which is entirely adequate for a single guy to live in. But I needed a shop to work on things. And so I built a shop. It was 28-by-32 with a wood shop upstairs. And I built that with the profits from my wages. And when I quit, I had a shop, and I decided I needed tools. It was the end of the year in October or November or something, and I decided I needed some tools. So I put an ad on Tradio back then, or in the newspaper, I can't remember which, and I got a few responses, but I got a response from a guy who says, I've got every tool you need. And so I went over and looked at him, and I said, yeah, but I can't afford them. I mean, this was a whole shop full of tools. And we talked for quite a while, and he said, well, how much money do you have? And I said, well, I've got $4,219 or something. And we talked for another hour after that, and then he said, well, load them up. And I said, what? And he says, yeah, I'll take the $4,200. I'll leave you 19, and you can have every tool in this place. And so it took me truckloads to get them all home. And all of a sudden, I had a shop and tools and $19 to my name. That was it. And so I put in a clutch for my neighbor. He asked me if I could put a clutch in his truck, and I said, sure. You know, do you have the book? Because I'd never put in a clutch in anything before, but he had the manual, and it told how to put in a clutch. So I did that for him. And then he says, well, I got a friend that needs a clutch in his truck, too. And so I put one in for him. And pretty soon I was fixing cars.
Hmm.
And I did that for a number of years.
All word of mouth?
All word of mouth. Just one person and next. And towards the end, I was way backed up.
Well, let me then ask you a little bit about that business side, because it eventually expands. You've got the mechanical skills. You've got the people skills. To marry those successfully in a commercial venture, you've got to be good with figures and books and getting, you know, making sure people pay you and handle your bills and all of that. Did that business side of things come naturally to you too?
Yeah, that part's pretty easy. It's, you know, dealing with the people is the challenging thing for most people who are trying to run some sort of mechanical business, is dealing with the people. And the business part's just a matter of making sure you have more money at the end of the month than you did at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to make a profit. And so you do the things that make money. And I didn't make much money for a lot of years. You know, I was learning to fix cars, and there's all sorts of mistakes were made. And it was a living.
You enjoyed it, though, right?
Oh, I did. Yeah. Working on cars was great. You get three rewards for every car you work on. The first, it was a puzzle. You had to figure out what was wrong and how to fix it. And that was... I am deep at heart a puzzle person. I still do puzzles all the time. But cars were a puzzle, and so you figure it out, and then the owner would come back in, and they'd be happy to get their car back all fixed. And then you got paid. And so it's three bonuses for every car you worked on. And that suited me really well. I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Though, when did you become a family guy?
Yeah, it kind of, there's a bunch of things happened all at once, sort of in 1989 or so.
The planets aligned.
Evidently they did. I got married. I met my wife down in Sitka. I had actually known her little sister in high school for a while, and she was living right across from her. My wife, Jill, was living right across from my mother, right down the street, and they were good friends. And so this was somewhat of an arranged marriage. My mother invited her over for Christmas dinner. But so getting married was a big part.
It was a distance relationship then? And what would you, would she come up here? Would you go down there? Because that's a big swath of territory to have a relationship across.
Yeah, we did both. And then one of the best things we did is we flew to Portland together in April one year. And I went down a couple days early to buy a car. And I ended up buying a 1969 Lincoln with suicide doors and leather upholstery. And it was quite the car. And we cruised it from Portland down, all the way down the coast, down to San Diego, and then across and then up through the, on the other side of the Sierras, up to the desert and whatnot. And we had a really good trip. Yeah, we did a few trips together. We went to Australia just, when we were in Australia, we decided to get married. And we tried to get married in Australia, but they have laws about staying in the same place for a month and things like that. So we got married when we got home.
Oh, nice. Where was the ceremony?
Jill's folks' house. It was very small, just Jill and I and her sister and her parents.
Nice. Okay, so she comes up to Fairbanks. In one year, you not only adopt twins. And I want to hear why twins, because I now have twin grandkids, and it's double the work. And so, yeah. Anyway, how did that come about?
Well, we tried to have our own kids, and that, you know, seemed like it wasn't going to happen for various reasons. And so we decided, well, we want kids, we'll adopt kids. It's easy enough. And so then you start looking into adoption, and you have an adoption agent who, in Fairbanks, here was a lady named Jay who came over and did a home study. So she, you know, visited with us and decided that we were appropriate parents. And so this is mandated by the state, I think. And so she called up the adoption agency and called us, you know, it was like 3 weeks into the process and said, well, are you sitting down? And I said, yeah. And she says, she got Jill on the other line. And she said, well, how about twins? And when we had decided to adopt a child, we had decided we wanted an infant and that we wanted a healthy infant. Those were our only two stipulations. And so in this case, we got two healthy infants. And
did you guys know what you were in for with twins?
Oh, no, not at all. It happened very fast. From the time they asked us if we would accept twins till the time we had them was, you know, less than 2 weeks. We went down to the airport and met an airplane, and there were some stewardesses who flew adopted children around, and they walked off the airplane, and they said, are you the parents? And we said, yep, and they said, here. it was all very fast. We walked out of the airport with two infants in arms and going, now what have we done?
I'm talking this episode and next with John Holmgren. John's shop out in Fox is often the site for wide-ranging discussions as well as no fooling around machine work and repairs. We'll hear more following a break. This is Northern Soundings. We'll be right back. Let's get back to my conversation with John Holmgren. His ability to create and maintain equipment out in the field led to a long career at the U.S. Army's Cold Region Research and Engineering Laboratory. Now, your kids are African American. Well, I'm sure with all adopted kids, at some point, they're curious about their biological parents. And that issue would seem to arise sooner when there's an obvious difference between the makeup of the kid and the makeup of the parents.
Yeah, our kids knew they were adopted from the time they were cognizant. We went to adoption club meetings where there was lots of other adopted kids and adoptive parents. You know, there was a twins club that they were in as well. But it was obvious they were adopted from early on.
Twins are notoriously or generally believed to be tighter as friends and as family than just your normal sibling. Is that true for your kids?
Well, most definitely. Yeah, when they were young, they talk about each other as the other one. They would, you know, if you took one of them to town and the other one stayed home, they'd always be, what's the other one doing? The other half, you know, really. And so they were very close. And they still are quite close. They talk all the time. And my son Adam just flew to Atlanta, where Erica lives, to visit her and her son. So, yeah, they have a bond that's fairly impressive.
And how did the rest of your family, did they just adapt? Because you come from a large family, right?
Oh, yeah. So I have three brothers and three sisters. And everybody just took our kids in stride.
I mean, isn't that wonderful?
Like other normal, you know, other unadopted kids, so to speak.
Now, here's the big question. Everybody our age, John, that has kids that have moved away, do you and Jill ever discuss, you know, you're so tied into the Fairbanks community. Do you ever think about moving closer to the kids?
Yeah, that's a topic under discussion these days. You know, what are we going to do when we, you know, being 65 now and, you know, have some choices to make, and what's it going to look like for the next 20 years? And certainly that's one of the options is, you know, moving closer to the kids or somehow figuring that out. Right now the kids aren't very close to each other, so that's not that easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're kind of
there must be like a geometric angle that you can pinpoint in Poughkeepsie.
Let's see, where does that put us where we have to live? Yeah, somewhere. So where's the straight line between Los Angeles and Atlanta? I think that puts us in Texas somewhere. I don't know. So we've certainly talked about that. I don't know how that's going to work out.
Yeah, good. Anything else about having a family, being a parent? Jill and you in retirement age?
Well, certainly one of the things, you know, we talked a lot about the work that I've done over the years. You know, I've been very busy and doing a lot of things. And Jill and I structured our relationship and our home, basically our family, in a very traditional way. I worked and she stayed home and took care of the kids for the most part, which has worked very well for us. And, you know, that was a conscious decision. She certainly bore the brunt and did most of the hard work of raising children. I probably worked too much and didn't spend enough time with the kids. If you look back on things, you go, well, why didn't I do this different? But at the time, the decisions are, they're not the same decisions when you look back on them 20 years later.
Sure.
You know, you have certain pressures that you tend to forget later when you look back.
Mm-hmm.
But Jill was, by far the most active parent in raising children.
Well, especially as you, you know, I for families like for me, I would always be at work and like Jill, Julie stayed home with the kids at least until they were in elementary school. But I came home every night. Sometimes when you're out in the field, you don't get to come home until months later sometimes.
Yeah, there were some long stints, and there were some pretty difficult things Jill had to do. Erica got an infection in her eye when she was quite young. I think she was less than two. And it was, you know, it could have been life-threatening very easily. You know, she ended up in the hospital and it was very traumatic. And I was nowhere within contact. You know, I didn't know anything about it till weeks later. You know, out on a snow machine trip somewhere. I can't remember where I was on that one. But so there's a number of things like that where Jill basically had to, deal with the problems. But she's very good at that and very competent, and she's added a lot of stability to my life, which is important. We've had a very solid, stable relationship.
Yeah, there's a lot of solace there and a lot of support and emotional context. Well, one final question then. You and Matthew cooked up this transarctic trip that you took off and reminded me many of, you know, people like Shackleton and whatnot who would go off to these places for months on end. Was there ever this sense that you were following in footsteps? You know, I mean, it's different when you have a sat phone. You can call if you have to.
Certainly.
It's very different in that respect. But that sense about going off into the unknown and then returning has a sort of a romantic but also a really interesting angle to it.
We read a lot of Arctic history, and both Matthew and I read a lot of Arctic history and climbing history and exploration history. But I guess I wasn't so much influenced by that as just the drive to get out and see new things. It wasn't the fact that somebody else did it and this is what you know, it's just sort of, you know, what I wanted to do. I wanted to go out and see, you know, or wanted to go out and do, to travel, you know.
Your kids going to urban Atlanta and L.A., very different from the choices you made as a young man.
Very different. And, my kids are just different individuals than I was, for sure. I don't know. I was brought up in a home where we were given, you know, we knew the rules and we knew what was right and wrong, but we were let loose we were given a lot of independence. You know, there's been seven of us kids. And we basically put ourselves through college. We're all self-employed except for one sister right now. And she's been self-employed in the past as well. An interesting dynamic, and I'm not sure whether you want to attribute that to our upbringing, the time and the place, genetics, who knows?
Who knows?
But we were brought up to be very independent people. And then the third thing that happened just about the same time is Matthew asked me if I'd come to work for him at Krell. And I kept telling him no, because I was pretty happy doing what I was doing. But one day I was kind of greasy and frustrated and told him, yes, I'll work for you, but only in the winters. I want summers off. But it was a winter job. Snow research was, and so that worked great.
Okay, we'll get to Matthew Sturm in just a minute. But one thing that you just said, it sounds like throughout your life, you would work really hard, but then you would have these periods when you could go pursue something that really interested you. Am I making sense? You know,
no, very much so. Alaska is a seasonal place for a lot of people. Work is a seasonal thing. You work in the summer and whatever you do in the winter. So going to school is very much the same way. You go to school and you kind of have to work in the summers. So if you want to go hitchhiking, you have to take off time from school. But I always took off time to do fun things. And I worked seasonally most of the time. Once I got married, it pretty much was working all the time because, you know, we needed certain things, cars. And when we adopted the children, then it's really full-time work.
Okay, let's divide then your work year and all that work into two sections. Matthew Sturm and Krell, Cold Regions
Research Engineering Lab.
And now we've talked with Matthew in the past on the show, but he's a snow scientist. He goes out and does a lot of research. Tell me how working in the field for science differed than working out in the field in mining?
Mining, when I was actually mining or running the placer mine, that was a much more industrial sort of process. We burnt 160,000 gallons of fuel. We had $1 million budget. I had 10 guys, and we were working, really working, in an industrial sense. Doing science, you go out and you're also really working, but it's different. You're measuring things and trying to figure things out. And so it's entirely a different job. It's in the field. You're out in snow research. We ended up doing a lot of long trips, and so you're living out there in a tent a lot of the time, and you're out. And so that part was different. You're traveling and seeing a lot of country. And
did mountaineering with Matthew, you get to really know a person. You must have known that on these extended things, Matthew was a compatible person for the trip, right?
Yeah, we worked together for 30 years. We had very much of an understanding of, you know, how our relationship worked. You know, Matthew was in charge. It was his project. He decided what we were going to do. My job was, besides doing snow science, it was keeping snow machines running. I guess it was a real partnership in that I, you know, had veto power on a lot of things where maybe other people in our group did not. Matthew and I worked very closely together planning and implementing science projects. Whereas generally he was in charge, I always knew that I had influence. And that was our relationship. We were very good friends, and we worked together a lot.
Mm-hmm. In his book, Finding the Arctic, about this long snow machine voyage across into Canada and over, you really get a sense that a guy like you, when Dan Soley's clutch goes out on the snow machine, you really suddenly, you're in the middle of nowhere. You can't really just call up a mechanic to have a part delivered. You've got to think on your feet. That must be true all the time out in the field. Is that right?
Yeah, a lot of times you got to make work. You got to make things work with what you've got. And Dan's clutch was kind of funny because it broke, and we ended up towing his snow machine into Old Crow. And we got into Old Crow, and Matthew and crew had been on the sat phone for the previous day calling all over trying to find a new clutch, which they couldn't find. They couldn't find somebody to deliver one to Old Crow. And so they were in a tizzy because the trip was planned ahead of time. All these places we were going to stop and talk to kids and schools, and they had a schedule. I was never much one for schedules, but that's the way it was. And so they were in a tizzy because this was going to throw the whole thing into a loop. And it was funny. They all went in to the Mounties to, you know, get processed into Canada. And I just gave them my passport. And I said, here's mine, and I'll be in there in a little bit. And while I was sitting outside, a guy named Peter Frost walked up, and he says, "What's wrong with the snow machine?" And I said, "Oh, it's got a bad clutch." And he goes, "I've got one that'll work on there." And I said, "Really?" And he goes, "Yeah." So we trudged off through the village, and we found a snow machine all covered with snow with no cowling on it or anything. And he says, "I think this clutch will fit." And so I said, "Yeah." And so then we had to get the clutch off, which is not easy to do on snow machines. But we managed pounding, and with some very primitive tools, a pipe wrench, as I remember, we managed to get this clutch off. And I went back over, and I put it on Dan's machine. I got his clutch off. I got the new one put on, and I had it running when the rest of the guys came out of the Mounties. And they were really quite surprised.
Yeah.
And we'd solved the problem in 10 minutes. They had agonized over for days and days and days, just fortuitously.
That's it for part one of my conversation with John Holmgren. Next week, we'll continue to discover about creating robust equipment out in the field and other adventures. Until that episode, I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.